Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've got unemployment, deficits, and a presidential campaign year bearing down on us. That was all clear in the White House Rose Garden yesterday. The president called for $3-plus trillion in deficit reduction over the next 10 years, and he did it in a way that will leave voters with a very clear choice. This hour on Point, the president's deficit plan and the way forward. You can join the conversation. Is the president right to take a tougher tack? Are you still hoping for a grand deal? Beyond the politics, if there's any way to get beyond them, would this plan fix the problem? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In the Rose Garden speech yesterday morning, President Obama pushed back against charges that his deficit reduction plan would represent class warfare.
Either we ask the wealthiest Americans to pay their fair share in taxes, or we're going to have to ask seniors to pay more for Medicare. We can't afford to do both. Either we gut education and medical research, or we've got to reform the tax code so that most profitable corporations have to give up tax loopholes that other companies don't get. We can't afford to do both. This is not class warfare. It's math.
And will he bargain? No. The president, who rarely speaks of a veto, spoke of a veto yesterday.
I will not support any plan that puts all the burden for closing our deficit on ordinary Americans. And I will veto any bill that changes benefits for those who rely on Medicare but does not raise serious revenues by asking the wealthiest Americans or biggest corporations to pay their fair share.
And we're off to the races. Republicans coming back hard, saying non-starter and saying, yes, indeed, class warfare. Joining me first today from Washington is John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, political writer for The New York Times. John Harwood, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom.
Politics aside for just a second, they can't stand aside long here. But what is most important in this plan, John?
The most important thing in this plan is the politics, Tom. It's the fact that the president, having tried and failed to negotiate a grand bargain with the House Speaker over the summer, has decided that if he's going to make a deal with Congress, it's going to be because he beats them over the head with public opinion and mobilizes them, forces them to come to him. He felt like he came a considerable distance toward the Republican position. Many in the Democratic base felt that way, too. He's finally said enough and is going to see if he can leverage the advantages that we've seen him get in some of the polls. Polls show that Americans want the wealthy to be taxed more, but he's not been able to convert those findings into effective pressure on Congress. And we're about to find out over the next couple of months if he can do it now.
So he's decided this is the club he wants to take into political battle. What is the club he's holding? What's he proposing, John?
He is proposing to limit deductions for taxpayers, families whose taxable income exceeds $250,000. That's the group that he proposes to also let the Bush tax cuts expire for.
Mm-hmm.
That would raise $800 billion over 10 years, simply that expiration. He wants to provide a floor underneath taxation for people with million-dollar incomes.
The so-called Buffett rule, as in Warren Buffett, billionaire.
Exactly. Warren Buffett has made a lot of noise publicly by saying he pays a lower effective tax rate than his secretary, in part because so much of his income comes as capital gains, investment income, rather than being taxed at higher personal income rates. And the president's saying, okay, Warren Buffett, you're right. I want to enact a principle like that. He didn't spell out how it would work, and that's one way you can tell that this is a political weapon more so than a serious legislative proposal, because they haven't spelled out exactly how it would work. They've said they're going to kick that to the Special Committee of Congress. He also wants to change the way some investment income is taxed so that it doesn't isn't taxed at the lower capital gains rates, the so-called carried interest that some investment partnerships benefit from. And he's also going after some tax breaks he's talked about before for corporate jets in the oil and gas industry.
He's talking about $3 trillion-plus in deficit reduction over the course of a decade. That's a combination of spending cuts, as he puts it, and higher taxes mainly on the wealthy. About $1.5 billion of that, as I looked at it, John, was from winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a huge chunk of the savings that in spending that he's claiming here. Is that a fair thing to claim?
Well, that's controversial. Republicans say it's spending that's not due to be spent anyway, so you can't really claim that you're cutting anything. On the other hand, Paul Ryan, the Republican chairman of the House Budget Committee, included those same savings in his own budget, which he put out. Everyone who feels the need to achieve and demonstrate a higher level of saving wants to claim those numbers, and the other side uses the fact that it's baked into the cake to kind of discredit them. But the truth is, the president did go light in this package on spending cuts, only $248 billion from Medicare. A long-term budget fix, as the White House knows, will require a lot more than that. And the president put more than that on the table in his negotiations with Boehner. He proposed not only changing the eligibility age for Medicare, raising it, but also changing the way Social Security benefits are adjusted for inflation. Neither of those two things are in the package he laid out yesterday. Why? Because his view is, until Republicans say they're willing to accept tax increases, he's not going to put those spending cuts on the table. That's what Democrats wanted. They didn't want him to put those things on the table. And the president's saying, okay, liberals who support me, I'm going to stand up for your position. And until they give on taxes, I'm not giving on benefits.
We see where this pushes politics, probably right into the lap of the 2012 campaign. Where does it push the economy and fiscal planning, John? We've got this congressional super committee up on the rails. Before Thanksgiving, it's supposed to come up with a trillion plus in savings, and people are saying they wish they'd do much more. But now you've got Boehner saying no new taxes and Obama saying, you know, nothing without some new taxes. Where does that leave the effort in Congress, which is a kind of a, you know, either they do it or they just come out bloody?
That's exactly the right question, and there are a couple of answers to it. First of all, on near-term benefits for the economy, I think despite the sharpened political rhetoric that we're hearing, it is likely that you will get some sort of a jobs bill passed in the form of a payroll tax cut extension. Remember, last year, Republicans and the president agreed on a 2% payroll tax cut for employees, not for employers. The president's proposing to expand that now. I think he's likely to get some version of that, maybe even a little infrastructure spending, because we do have a pending highway bill that's advancing in the Congress. So that's a short-term push for the economy. In terms of the long-term deficit reduction, I think that's not likely to yield very much in that super committee. The backstop for them is that there is a so-called sequester, a trigger, so that if the Congress doesn't pass a new deal on deficit reduction, steep cuts in defense and other programs would take place. However, they wouldn't take place until January of 2013. So there would be an entire year for Congress to fight about it, for an election to be held, and for Congress to come up with some plan C after the sequester, and I think that's what's likely to happen. I think we're going to be fighting about long-term deficit reduction all the way through Election Day, and some resolution will be made before those sequesters take effect in January 2013.
John, you've followed politics for a long time. If the president sticks with this angle, and we have, I don't know who it's going to be. I mean, no one knows. Rick Perry or Mitt Romney or, you know, Michelle Bachmann, John Huntsman. How stark is this choice going to be? Have you ever seen a choice as stark as what seems to be coming up here for the voting public?
Not in my career, and especially if Rick Perry receives the nomination. You know, Mitt Romney has been somebody who has tried to blur various lines in different points of his political career. He has been the front runner for the Republican nomination. This is a Tea Party Republican Party at the moment. Rick Perry's coming from nowhere. He's leading. That doesn't mean he's necessarily going to win the primaries, but he sketches the contrast much more sharply, and it certainly would meet the president in terms of fiery rhetoric. Rick Perry has talked about Social Security as a monstrous lie, a Ponzi scheme, something that's been a failure. You can expect that when it comes right down to it, the taxes question is a question of, are taxes going to go up, or is Social Security and Medicare going to go down a lot? If taxes go up a little bit, those programs are still going to have to be cut over the long term, but not as much. And so a real government, anti-government choice and trade-off for the American people, polls in past history would tell you that the Democratic argument would fare a little bit better with the independent voters who will decide the election. But there's nothing certain about that, and Rick Perry's an effective campaigner. We've seen that. And I think we would have a very dramatic election in 2012 if he's the nominee.
Do you see those who are in Washington right now, John Boehner and company, maneuvering to be open to a piece of this, some of it, none of it? Is it a stonewall or something else you see shaping up here?
We saw that John Boehner and Barack Obama, the president, got pretty close to a deal in the summer. But what happened was the Republican base in the Congress decided that they would not follow John Boehner if he was going to propose a tax increase. That's the bright line that Republicans have drawn. I think on everything else, there's the potential for compromise. But until you get that piece of it, you're not going to have a bipartisan deal. President Obama has made clear he accepts the need, and he said so in his speech to Congress a couple of weeks ago. He accepts the need for cuts in Medicare and Social Security, but he's not going to, and he said yesterday with that veto clip that you just played, he said yesterday that he's not going to accept them unless there's tax increases. There are some Republicans in Congress who agree with that. Bipartisan commissions have concluded that. The Simpson-Bowles Commission concluded that. Pete Domenici and Alice Rivlin had a bipartisan commission. Everybody, all those bipartisan commissions have said we need some taxes and some benefit cuts. Republicans in the House have not been willing to go along with that. Until they do, we're not going to have a big deal.
We're going to dive straight on in here. John Harwood with CNBC and the New York Times with us today from Washington. Thank you so much, John.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the president's new deficit reduction plan. Combative, not compromising, President Obama in the Rose Garden yesterday. The president quoted George Washington, saying that the first president understood as well the difficulties involved in tackling a country's debt.
He understood that dealing with the debt is, these are his words, always a choice of difficulties. But he also knew that public servants weren't elected to do what was easy. They weren't elected to do what was politically advantageous. It's our responsibility to put country before party. It's our responsibility to do what's right for the future.
What's right for the future? But what is that? The president went right after Republicans who vowed not to raise any taxes. He said middle-class families shouldn't pay higher taxes than millionaires and billionaires.
Anyone who has signed some pledge to protect every single tax loophole so long as they live, they should be called out. They should have to defend that unfairness. Explain by somebody who's making $50 million a year in the financial markets should be paying 15% on their taxes when a teacher making $50,000 a year is paying more than that, paying a higher rate. They ought to have to answer for that.
There was fast GOP response. Speaking to Chris Wallace of Fox News yesterday morning, even before the speech, talk about fast, Republican Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin criticized the president's call for additional taxes on the wealthy.
Class warfare, Chris, may make for really good politics, but it makes for rotten economics. We don't need a system that seeks to divide people. We don't need a system that seeks to prey on people's fear, envy, and anxiety. We need a system that creates job and innovation and removes these barriers for entrepreneurs to go out and rehire people. But I'm afraid these kinds of tax increases don't work.
And at the University of Cincinnati yesterday, here was House Speaker John Boehner on the president's call for higher taxes on the wealthy.
I understand that it's easy to go out there and talk about taxing billionaires. Listen, if they want to pay more, there's a special provision in the tax code for them to write a check to the federal government.
Let's dig on in here. Joining me now in the studio is David Osborne, senior partner at Public Strategies Group, a consulting firm for governments and public organizations. He served as a senior advisor to Vice President Al Gore in the 1990s, helping run the National Performance Review Task Force on Reforming Federal Government, co-author of The Price of Government, Getting the Results We Need in an Age of Permanent Financial Crisis. David Osborne, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Tom.
Also with us from Washington is Russ Roberts, professor of economics at George Mason University, distinguished scholar at George Mason's Mercatus Center, research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He hosts the weekly Econ Talk podcast and blogs at Cafe Hayek, as in Friedrich Hayek, the Austrian economist and conservative idol. His latest book is The Price of Everything, A Parable of Possibility and Prosperity. Russ Roberts, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Russ, let me come first to you. You've got a conservative take on this. What do you see?
Well, I just have to say first that I'm not a conservative. I'm what Hayek and others called a classical liberal. But my take on it
is... You sure would pass in today's America.
I understand. If you got to pigeonhole me, though, use my name, not the rest of the world's. I think it's a... Obviously, there's a huge element of politics here. But if we step back and we look at this as a serious proposal, I have a couple quick thoughts. One is... $3.3 trillion sounds like a big number. Over 10 years when we're spending now $3.6, $3.8 trillion a year, it's not a very big number. Number two, when we change the burden of taxes, we should keep in mind the incentives, not so much for economic growth, which is what everybody focuses on, but I would look at the political economy, the incentives it has for what government should do. Right now, the top 1% in the latest numbers pays 38% of the income tax revenue. The bottom 50% pays 3% or so, something under 5%. There's also payroll taxes, but most people don't think of those. They think those are for their retirement and their Medicare. If you think that a dollar of government spending costs you a nickel or less, you're going to a lot bigger government, and I think that's bad public policy. I think we ought to move... If anything, we ought to move away from an income tax toward a consumption tax. But if we're going to change the burden, we ought to make sure that everybody pays something in the income tax system. The last thing I would say is we spend about $3.8 trillion a year. We used to spend closer to $2.5. I don't think we've gotten very much for that extra money. It'd be easy to cut out $1.3 trillion a year and not punish poor people, children, and the elderly. And that's the direction we ought to move.
David Osborne, first, the scale of what he's proposing in terms of deficit reduction on the face of it. And what about Russ Roberts saying, cut out $1.3 trillion a year, no problem?
Well, on the scale, I agree with Russ.
Too small.
It's all too small. They're politicians. And what they're going to have to do if we're not to have a terrible financial crisis sometime in the next 10 years because of the debt is inflict pain on us. And they don't want to do that. So, you know, they talk about $4 trillion a year. Both sides are talking about that. It sounds like a nice big number, but Russ is right. If you use...
$4 trillion over 10 years.
Ten years, yes. Mm-hmm. If you use realistic economic assumptions, which the Congressional Budget Office hasn't done, their assumptions are rosy.
And they're supposed to be the judge here.
Yeah. We're probably going to build up $13 to $15 trillion in new debt in the next 10 years. Okay, so let's cut $4 trillion of that. We're down to $9 to $11 trillion in new debt. In other words, we're going to double the debt in the next 10 years.
Does that put us into Europe danger zone?
It does.
Europe-style danger?
In my opinion, it does. It's not enough. It's a good down payment. On the second question... You know, I defy anyone to cut $1.3 trillion out of the federal budget without inflicting enormous pain. I mean, we're talking about 75% of federal spending is payments to individuals. It's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, pensions, retiree benefits for veterans, food stamps, etc. 75% of it. So you either cut that by 10% and eliminate everything else, eliminate the Defense Department, the Transportation Department, the Justice Department, et cetera. Or, much more reasonable, you cut payments to individuals by close to 35%. That hurts. That's Social Security. That's Medicare. That's Medicaid. Those are the big three.
Let us set that aside for a moment. That's not on the table at this point.
No.
The president is not going hammer and tongs or even a little at Social Security and only a very little at Medicare. Is he being straightforward? He's being very straight in his terms with the wealthy. Is he being straight with the rest of the country? Can we duck those reforms that he was talking about only a few months ago and get on top of the deficit?
Well, neither party's being straight on Social Security. Both parties have done the same thing. Paul Ryan and the House Republicans did exactly the same thing. They said, we have to deal with Social Security, but we're not going to put it in our budget. They understand it's the third rail of American politics, and they're not willing to go first. That's got to be a bipartisan commission that, as in 1983, when Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan did this, agrees to the small changes we need in Social Security. Social Security is not a big problem. It's a small problem.
But do something.
Yes. Medicare is the big problem. I mean, basically, what's going on in this country, which people don't quite understand, it's not that politicians have gone crazy with spending. Two things have happened. The baby boomers have begun to turn 65 mm-hmm. and qualify for Medicare and Social Security. And we all know the baby boom generation is huge. We're going to, in the next 25 years, we're going to almost double the number of people 65 and older.
Just demographics at work.
Demographics. The second thing is the rising cost of health care. For the last 50 years, we've spent, on average, 10% more on health care in this country every year. And we're getting to the point where it's 18% of our economy, and it's bankrupting us. So you put that together, and you get a cost explosion in Medicare, which is health care for the elderly.
What about Russ Roberts' observation that the top, I think he said 1%, already pay 38%, nearly 40% of the nation's income taxes? Now he's leaving.
Yes, the Republicans always say this. Mm-hmm. But what they don't say is the federal income tax is one small portion of the tax burden on all of us. We also pay Social Security taxes, mm-hmm. Medicare taxes, state income taxes, sales taxes, gas taxes. And Warren Buffett is right. His secretary pays a higher tax rate than he does when you include all of that. Now, you know, if asking the rich to go back to their tax rates of the 1990s mm-hmm. is class warfare, then the 1990s must have been class warfare. Yet, if you look at the data, we did very well in the 90s. The rich did well. The middle class, the middle 60% of the income distribution under Clinton's tax rates, after having 20 years of no growth in their incomes, grew 2% a year. The bottom grew 2.5% a year in income. We all did well. And Obama is saying, look, it's time that we went back to a rational income tax system.
Russ Roberts, how about it? What's so class warfare-like about going back to 1990s tax rates?
Well, again, I think the fundamental question is how do you do that and what are the implications of it?
I mean, we did it then, and David Osborne points out we flourished.
Well, that's not the same point as the Buffett point, right? The Buffett point's a statement about where your income comes from. So if you decide that it's, quote, unfair that a millionaire who earns income through investments is taxed at a lower rate than a person who works for a living, mm-hmm. You're going to have consequences if you change those tax rates. You're going to discourage the accumulation of capital. You're going to discourage productivity.
But we had higher capital gains tax rates in the past and higher growth at the same time.
Well, you got to look at everything. You can't just point to one thing, right? There are a lot of reasons we had higher growth rates in the past. Some of them related to the capital gains tax, some of them not related. I think if you isolate that impact, you'd as many economists have done, you see an impact on capital accumulation, which hurts poor people not to have a lot of capital. It's one of the reasons we're a very wealthy nation. It's one of the reasons that if you're poor in America, you're much wealthier and healthier than a poor person outside of America. But I don't think anything's horrible about raising tax rates on the rich. I don't think there's a huge incentive effect on work effort, as some people claim. I don't think that's the central issue. The mm-hmm. central issue is what do we spend? How much does the government spend versus how much the private sector spends and whether it's spent wisely? How we finance that, there's some importance to it. You can design a really stupid tax code. You can design a better one. I think it's much easier than David thinks to cut federal spending by a large amount without inflicting pain. One thing I'd do is I'd stop channeling money through the government to rich people, through Social Security, through Medicare, through subsidies, through loopholes. I think every thoughtful person agrees with that our political system is currently helping politically powerful people too much, particularly in the financial sector. Those are the important ways we distort the distribution of income. So I think that is something we can agree on. Let's close loopholes for everybody. That would be great if we had a simpler tax code. We'd liberate a lot of tax accountants and lawyers to do something productive instead of simply look at ways to avoid taxes. Plus, we'd get better and wiser economic choices from all of us. So I think it's a little bit of a red herring, this class warfare issue, to focus on it. It's interesting. It makes for a lot of screaming and yelling. But the really crucial issue is what we spend our resources on and where they come from and the incentives that we give people. The money that we have transferred to the wealthiest people in human history in the financial sector through government bailouts going back to 1984.
You're talking about Wall Street.
We're talking about Wall Street and investment banks generally around the world, unfortunately. The money that we have helped those people with by bailing out financial institutions that lend money badly, which is what we've done systematically for the last 25 years, has distorted two things. It's distorted the payoffs to those people, and equally importantly, it's distorted what we do with our capital. We need to fix that. So a lot of this to me is just it's a sideshow. It's interesting. It's entertaining. It's small potatoes compared to the real issues.
The challenges spread out in many, many directions once you start to look in here. But the president focusing very much yesterday on here's what we offer to Americans. Here's what the wealthy pay. We want to change the ratio, he's saying. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, our economic crunch right now is caused by the fact that demand has basically dried up. And there's a good reason for that, and that's because demand was always driven by the middle class, and the middle class has gotten very poor. The U.S. is 64th in income inequality, right below Ivory Coast, Cameroon, and Iran. For the last 30 years, more than 80% of the total increase in American incomes went to the richest 1%, and they now take home about a quarter of all the income in the United States, which is why Warren Buffett says there is class warfare, all right, but it's the rich that's making the war, and they're winning. Now, as has been pointed out, President Obama wants the top earners to go back and pay about what they paid under Clinton, at which point I'd like to remind people unemployment was 3.9%. Now, I don't think that's class warfare, but since the Republicans do, the question I think everybody needs to ask them is, whose side are you on?
Well, certainly that's the question the president's going to be asking all through the campaign season next year. Let us test it. Mark, I appreciate your call. David Osborne, you heard the president say we played the tape. He's laying this out as a kind of choice. Either we gut education and medical research, or we reform the tax code and get more from the wealthiest Americans. It's like, what do you want, America? Is that a fair description of where we stand here? Can you really?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is, and I believe, I think John Harwood in the opening segment was right. I think there won't be a grand compromise before the election in 2012 because the Republican Party has been very clear, no tax increases. And the president yesterday was very clear. So this is what the next election will be fought over.
But is it fair to say rich Americans just shell out some more and we can fix these problems? I thought you opened up saying
that's not enough. Mm-hmm. That's actually gets you something like $80 billion a year. You know, when we're running deficits of $1.3 trillion a year. So that's a small part of the solution. And frankly, in my opinion, other people should be paying higher taxes too. If we want true economic health, we should go back to the tax rates of the 1990s.
So maybe it is class warfare not to say all that at the same time.
Well, you know, you could also say it's class warfare on the part of the Republicans to say take the cuts out of Medicaid for the poor and Medicare for the elderly.
And leave the rich alone.
Sure, we're talking about who's going to suffer. We have gotten into a situation largely thanks, frankly, to President Reagan and President George Bush II. We've gotten into a situation of where we have way too much debt, and we've got to deal with it, and that means pain. So the question in 2012 will be, do we take all the pain by cutting spending on things that poor people and the middle class rely on, or do we share the pain by raising taxes on the wealthy, reforming our tax system so that there are fewer loopholes, raising taxes on oil companies, taking away those loopholes, et cetera, and spending cuts. I mean, the president is saying $2 of spending cuts for every dollar of tax increases. So,
is he delivering on that what he announced yesterday?
Roughly, yeah, roughly.
If you count the Iraq and Afghanistan wars going away as spending cuts.
Yes, exactly.
Which he does.
Yes.
big time in here. David Osborne, Russ Roberts, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the president's speech in the Rose Garden yesterday, laying out his plan, he said, for deficit reduction and taxation, more on the rich, over the next 10 years. David Osborne is with us, senior partner at Public Strategies Group, with me in the studio. With us from Washington, Russ Roberts is here, professor of economics at George Mason University. Let's go right to our callers. Libba in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for calling, Libba. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Glad to be with you.
Good to have you. What do you think?
Well, I think that class warfare is the wrong call for this. But on the other hand, I think the president is being a little bit playing his cards in that direction. We need to change the tax code. There's no doubt about it. I bring up one point, the fact of charitable donations in anyone that makes $200 to $250 for families. I'm in the arts business, and we get most of our money from people in that category. Well, the best way to not do anything about that is to quit making those charitable donations. That needs to be looked at, because that is taking money directly out of the economy and putting it into the government.
You mean
profit.
If he ends the tax deductibility of those donations, which is on the table
right.
here? Mm-hmm.
Yes, that I think will have dire consequences. I also saw a poll today, and I'm not at that. I think it was a Gallup poll, but it was a question of how much money do people think is wasted by the government? 51 cents on the dollar was the answer. So politically, if you look at it, and people are thinking that the government's wasting 51 cents on the dollar or using 49 cents well, then is it politically expedient for the Democrats to be after this without thinking we need to also be showing some really true cuts out there? When this independent voter comes in, he's not going to be thinking class warfare. None of us are going to be thinking class warfare.
Well, that's the president's gamble right there, isn't it, Libby? He's gambling that they're going to, if he says, you know, we're going to lose all these government services that you're accustomed to and depend on, or we're going to raise taxes on the top. You say it's waste. That's the gamble right there in the voting booth. Let us hold that thought. I appreciate your call. And one more, Bonita in New Haven, Connecticut. Bonita, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a registered Democrat. I've been registered my whole voting life since I was 18. That doesn't mean I've always voted Democrat. I always try to vote the way I feel is best for the country. So I have voted for one Republican president.
Okay.
However, I'm mainly Democrat, and I really was very happy to see President Obama finally stand up for something without trying to compromise, because you can't always compromise with people. If they don't want to compromise, then you need to do what's best for the country, no matter what people think about you. Everybody's not going to like you, you know, and I sometimes think that he's trying to get everybody to like him.
Bonita, when people get in the voting booth, Bonita, to Libba's point from Charlotte, North Carolina, do you think they're going to vote with the president, or going to think, you know what, government spending has got too much waste in it anyway, I cannot go with this man's view?
I think that people will vote with the president, because I believe, yeah, there is a lot of government waste, but there's always been a lot of government waste. The question is he doing something to help me being the generic voter? And if they believe that that's the case, they will vote for him despite government waste.
Bonita, I appreciate your call. And one more, Omaha, Nebraska. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I couldn't agree more with what the president said yesterday, and I think it was wonderful. This is the president that I, as a Midwestern Union member, voted for last November. And so far as class warfare, like other people have said, and I think even fellow Omahan Warren Buffett said, that the rich have been perpetrating this class war on the working class and the middle class for a long time, and it's time to fight back. If they want a war, you know, it's on.
But the question I have is, yes.
In regards to the job creators that they talk about, let me give this example, and maybe somebody can answer it.
Okay.
If you have a business, and maybe you have 100 employees, and you generate revenue of $50 million a year, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're working the business hard and everything, and next year you generate $60 million worth of revenue, but you do not have to, without adding any more employees, where's the incentive to add more employees? Thanks.
I'm trying to follow the economics there, Patrick. Russ, let me bring it to you on the job creator front. You hear Patrick, union man in Omaha, saying, you know, if this is class warfare, let's go. It's already on. What about the job creation part of this? The Republicans have talked about that for a long time and warned that if you raise taxes here, the job creation goes away. Patrick's skeptical. What do you say, Russ?
Well, Patrick's worrying about increased productivity, the fact mm-hmm. that sometimes you can get more output without hiring fewer people. It's not he's more revenue as an example, mm-hmm. but usually mm-hmm. we're also talking about more output.
Right.
That's how we get richer as a nation and as individuals. Usually, though, other jobs are getting created. Right now, the job machine is not doing its job to replace those lost jobs through increased productivity as it has in the past. But I want to come back to some of these inequality issues. I think earlier caller who talked about the recession occurring because the middle class is struggling and they don't have any money and then
demand
has gone
away,
anything.
Nobody's buying, yep.
Yeah, that's not true in the data, and I think the whole story about the middle class disappearing is a myth. It's a distortion of the data. If you look at consumer spending, it's back to its level above what it was when the recession started. If you look at the income that goes to the middle three-fifths of the country since 2000 to 2007 when median income was flat, but somehow the top three-fifths got the same proportion or a little bit more actually than they'd been getting of a growing pie.
But have you seen the poverty numbers that came out last week? The median income down
Sure.
I saw under 50,000, the unemployment.
Yep. When you have recession and you have high unemployment, there's a lot of suffering. We're not talking about mm-hmm. that. We're talking about the broad fabric of the rules of the game. Where I agree with the caller and where I think I agree with David is we need to share the pain. But the question is, how do you share it in a way that's effective? And I would start by getting rid of all the government program. Taxes are dramatic, and people talk about them all the time. And again, I'd emphasize that if we raise taxes on the wealthy, the effects will be relatively small, both in revenue and fairness terms that everyone's worried about. The bigger piece of the puzzle is the things that government does to help rich people, not through the tax code, but through government spending and programs.
But you're
We give lots of money to rich farmers. Get rid of that.
That's in here. But you go further. If I read you right, just yesterday, I think, Russ, or the day before, you're saying let's get government out of education pretty much entirely.
Yeah, does a bad job. It's we've increased the amount of spending per pupil in the United States steadily. So this with very little, if no return. So this claim that if we somehow cut certainly federal spending on education, that children are going to suffer is not true. There's no evidence for it. It could be true, of course. It could be we just haven't spent enough. But we have tried over the last four decades to spend more through more administrators, through higher payments to teachers, through smaller classroom sizes, and the payoff has been almost zero. We've made a lot of friends of people who get that money, the consultants, the administrators, and the teachers. We have not made better educated Americans, particularly in the inner cities. We have punished an entire generation of minority and low-skill people in the inner cities, and it's despicable. It is a scandal. It is an outrage.
Let us pick that up, if we may. Russ, David Osborne, this really does bring it down to a vote on government. If this is the framing for next year's presidential campaign, if it could be Rick Perry, we don't know, but surely that tone has crept into many of the candidates at this point. I mean, here's Russ who would get government out of education. That's a vote of no confidence in government.
Let me ask Russ, are you saying the federal government or government?
Well, I'd start with the federal government because I think it does very little.
The federal government is like 7% of what we spend on education.
And you're
probably right.
He'd start there. That
wouldn't change a lot. But it's also it wouldn't do much for the deficit. It's not a huge amount of money.
It would help the state deficits, actually, which is going to be part of where, of course, the federal money's been going, and I'm worried it's going to continue to
go. If we cut federal spending on education, it would hurt state deficits. And frankly, the biggest drag on the economy right now is state and local government. They're laying people off. They're laying 25,000 people off every month, and that is taking probably 1% off our GDP. But I want to go back to this income inequality question.
Sure.
Since 1973, the middle 60% of the income distribution has barely gained in real terms, inflation-adjusted terms. And there are two groups within it that have lost a lot of ground. The way the middle class has stayed above, with their heads above water, is by having two earners in the family. Mm-hmm. Okay, women have gone to work since 1973. Yep. Households where the woman doesn't work have lost a lot of ground. They've become poorer. And white males have lost a lot of ground. They've become poorer. So the one exception to in the last 40 years were the 8 years under Bill Clinton. That's the one exception to this trend. And what did Bill Clinton do? He cut spending and raised taxes, which is what President Obama is trying to do. Sure, he did.
He did
sure
not
he
cut
did. He cut spending. He cut the federal payroll, for example. He cut the workforce by about 300,000. He cut defense spending. You know, as a percentage,
spending in 1999 was lower than it was in 1993. In 2001 is lower than it was in 1993.
As a percentage of GDP?
Oh, that's a different question.
Well, that's the real question.
Let me, if I may, because our time's going. I want to get to Medicare and okay. This is the big one in there: Medicare, Medicaid.
Yep.
And I want to get from each of you your view on what the president's putting out here. David, I know you've been poking around in the weeds here, and yep. There's some elements that haven't been talked about much on what might be coming on that front here.
Yeah, most of what's been talked about are the cuts. And most of the cuts go to providers, that is hospitals and doctors, and drug companies. The big losers would be drug companies, and 10% of the cuts to recipients. But there's something very interesting that the media hasn't picked up on that the president said in his speech. He said, we've got to stop paying for volume of services, in other words, paying for procedures through a fee-for-service reimbursement system in Medicare, and we've got to start paying for health. What he's talking about is shifting from the current payment system where every time a doctor does a lab test or a procedure,
the meter's
they get,
running and
right, they
more
get
cost.
Reimbursed. Mm-hmm. So what do they do when they're squeezed? They do more procedures to a system called global payments where they get one payment to take care of the person for the year.
So the incentive is turned around. Their incentive is to do it efficiently. Is that in what the president laid out yesterday?
It is, but it's kind of a little hidden. He said it during his speech, and he's got a proposal. When you read the plan, he's got a proposal for his independent panel advisory board for Medicare.
Which is this already in the Obama health plan?
Yes, it was created by the health plan, but he's got a proposal to strengthen it dramatically.
But he's not claiming spending cuts on
and
the basis of this.
Give it the authority to shift the payment model.
But he's not claiming any savings on this.
No. That's what's so interesting. Clearly, this is where the administration wants to go, but it's not out front yet. And frankly, it's the most important thing we could do. There are ways to reform how we spend money that over time will create enormous savings, and this is the biggest one.
Russ, have you been under the hood there? What do you see coming on the Medicare side? I mean, we see the headlines here, $248 billion saved from reducing overpayments, the president says, and $72 billion on other health and Medicaid savings. What about this plan and health spending?
Well, I'm sure we could administer Medicare a little more effectively. I think that, again, is a little bit of a red herring. You started off earlier by referring to my blog, Cafe Hayek, and the economist F.A. Hayek. He said, the curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. Over the last 50 years in America, we have steadily – it's a steady change – we've changed the medical system to be a system where people used to pay a significant amount out of pocket for every dollar of spending. They paid 60 or so cents 50 years ago. At least over 50 cents, and now it's down to about 15 cents. When you spend other people's money, you spend it easily and widely. That's the reason our medical care costs keep rising. And if we don't fix that, we can do all the fiddling we want with trying to change what people's incentives are, but it's not going to work very well.
But you're giving us a philosophy lesson there. And what is it? If we're going to be in a big presidential ballyhoo next year, are you saying we only imagine we can design our society? We should just get out of it? Laissez-faire, let it roll?
Well, I'd let a lot of things be laissez-faire that can work better than what the government does. Yeah, the government's done a very poor job in the things it's most involved in. What is it most involved in? Housing, horrible. Great at boosting home ownership costs for a while, helped create a housing bubble that has been devastatingly destructive. Education, I think it does a horrible job helping the politically weak and helps the politically powerful. It's most both at the K-12 and at the university level. Most government activity subsidizes wealthier people at the expense of poorer people. And in the healthcare system, we've made sure that the healthcare system is booming. It has many benefits, by the way, lots of good things about it. But one of the costs is our costs are rising and our demographics are going to kill us. So we need to get government out of that decision-making process at the micro level, which it tries to do now, and it does it very poorly.
You can hear maybe a Perry-Obama debate shaping up right there. One more call. Tony in Iowa City, Iowa. Tony, you're on the air.
Howdy. My question's about the cuts that were given in tax breaks to the large corporations while the government lived off the Social Security slushy fund in order to create jobs. Well, my experience, I've seen them leave the country with our jobs, and we've gotten nothing back, and now we're in desperate trouble with our Social Security system. And, of course, I'm beginning to wonder if I'll ever see anything out of it at all while I'm still paying in.
So you're not buying that those tax cuts brought jobs here. You saw them go overseas. David Osborne, here's the big setup for the jump ball of this next election. Russ Roberts is, very straightforward in his deep skepticism about what government has produced. Here's Tony, deeply skeptical about what private industry produced when it was favored with government favors, and he only go to 2012.
Absolutely. I think we can all be deeply skeptical about what the private sector produces on its own. It gave us the Depression. It gave us the Great Recession in the last 3 years.
Also gave us a pretty rich country after 200
exactly.
years.
The market economy is very powerful. It works best, clearly, when government has a role, when government regulates it, and when government deals with market failures and fills in the places the market is not going to provide.
Russ Roberts says, come on, look at Wall Street. Bail it out, and you just kept the incentives bad. We're still in danger.
Well, I don't think we're still in danger from Wall Street collapsing as we were in 2008. We're in danger from government debt. It's a new game. But yes, I think the 2000 election is going to come down to which road do we take? Do we take the low-tax, low-service road that Texas has taken over the years, or do we take a more moderate road balanced between tax increases and spending cuts and reforms that Obama wants to take?
You call it moderate. Russ Roberts might call the other road the effective road. This is the debate that we're going to hear, and you two have helped lay it out very well for us. I appreciate that today, coming just the day after the president's speech. Russ Roberts at George Mason University, thank you very much for being with us today, Russ.
My pleasure. Republicans talk about cutting spending. They rarely do. We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. David Osborne with Public Strategies Group, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.